Hello and welcome to the Let's Talk Bipolar podcast, hosted by Emma Bell and brought to you by Bipolar UK. You can find all of our resources at www.bipolaruk.org. So welcome, April, to the Bipolar UK Let's Talk podcast. How are you?
Hello, thank you for having me. I am good. How are you?
Yeah, an okay day today. So like we just said, you know, when we have an okay day, we take it as a win. So that's where I'm at today.
Good.
I'm really glad that you're here today. And I'd love to talk to you a bit about your journey, you to share a little bit about who you are, where you come from, before we get into bipolar and how that's affected your life and showed up in your life. So tell us a little bit about you.
Yes, so I am an actor and producer. I am one of the ambassadors for Bipolar UK. So I trained at drama school, and that is where I started my production company, Mini Productions, at the age of 21, because believe it or not, I don't know how many people realize this, but acting isn't a stable career. So I realized I wanted something within the industry as well to be that consistent flow of money. And I'm glad I did it, because I preempted the one thing I now know I can't do, and that is work for someone else. So it really worked out well. I met my business partner a year or so after starting the company, and we've been ploughing forth ever since. And I've been juggling both the acting and producing. Yeah.
Amazing. And can you tell me, let's talk about bipolar first, and then I'd like to talk to you about how you manage bipolar alongside your career and everything that you do. But let's go back. And if you could share with me, what is your diagnosis and when did you receive your diagnosis?
So I am bipolar type 2, and I also have borderline personality disorder. They kind of come as a pair. They're certainly really good friends. And it wasn't a shock that also came along with it. I've suffered since the age of 15, but I didn't get formally diagnosed until I was 27. Which is kind of typical, as we know, for bipolar. It really shamefully can take up to 10 years to get diagnosed. So hearing that statistic was a bit bittersweet, because it brought a little bit of comfort, but then also, why are we still in this position that it takes that long to get a diagnosis? And I've been on medication since the age of 18, pretty much a pick and mix of everything that you can possibly think of. And I think I got to about 22, 23, and I just took myself off of all medication because I was just fed up. I just was fed up of feeling like a robot and not feeling anything. And in hindsight, that probably wasn't my smartest decision. So I did go back onto medication, kicking and screaming. But really, it has only been in the last year and a half where I've taken responsibility, or as much responsibility as one can have when you are living with bipolar, to look after myself. So I did therapy when I was 18, on and off for a few years, but I recently have gone back into it wholeheartedly. I hit rock bottom and I thought, right, let's just throw as much mud to the wall and see what will stick.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that you say that. Similarly, I got misdiagnosed with depression when I was 15, 16, and received a formal diagnosis when I was 29, bipolar. So, but that's why I like to ask that question, because when we get diagnosed is always most commonly a very different answer to when we were first affected by bipolar, right? And it does seem to be like this decade, a decade passes, and we are navigating life with bipolar very much affecting us and the people around us. And guess what? We're doing our best when we're playing in the dark.
Yeah, Yeah, exactly. And it is, it's, that's one of the things that I really wonder if I'm ever going to get over or be able to work through, because I genuinely feel like I missed years of my life from about the age of 18, 19 to 24, 25. And actually meeting my business partner was the game changer. She reminded me what it was to feel alive, and also enabled me to trust and love again. But I always wonder what I could have done in my early 20s. But then I also think I'm probably one of the rare people out there that wasn't out there partying and getting drunk. And I actually instead focused on building a career and needing a purpose. So mm-hmm. building mm-hmm. this company. So I do wonder, would I be married by now if I was going out and meeting more people and not just hiding in the flat, or would I have the success I have now if I didn't mm-hmm. work so hard?
Mm-hmm. I mean, on the flip side, I suppose I was that person that was going out all of the time, but in lots of ways I abused that as a way to cope with big feelings that I didn't know how to feel. And also when I was hypomanic, you know, I'd go out for days and days at a time. So I'm not sure. I mean, the comparison is the thief of all healing and all joy, right? But in it's interesting that you say that, because I am the flip side to your story in many ways. But I certainly abused that and I abused myself in that process as ways of coping, but also as ways of riding the manic wave and then crashing and hiding.
Yeah. What I found really interesting, and again, Sarah and my mum will back this up, is actually when I got that diagnosis, I think I was so angry, and I felt not hard done by. I just thought, screw you, bipolar. Now you've decided that this is it. You've now decided to finally push me enough to get this diagnosis. I then in my head went, I lost out on so many years, so many of my party years, and really made up for it. To the point where Sarah and my mum had to really just sit me down and go, you can't do this. You can't always use the excuse that you lost your early 20s. So it's very strange. I do feel like, and I don't know if in terms of the way that you, your behaviour reacted, but I feel like I'm very not emotionally immature. I just feel like I am not as far ahead in what society believes you should be. I've just turned 30 and I've got no relationship. I'm not really going by the book with anything. And that scares me more now than pretty much anything. So I don't know if you if you felt like that held you back, but you're in a lovely relationship, aren't you?
But I've been married and divorced, and yeah, so you know, I suppose maybe being out there led me to more opportunity to meet people, but at the same time it was chaotic and intense and not healthy. And you know, I was in a 7-year relationship, bought a house, left that, had a complete breakdown, you know, and then got very quickly got married, and that wasn't a healthy relationship, so that broke down, so now I'm divorced, and you know, so I'm 39 now, you know, and
oh my god, you do not look it.
I'm definitely 39 at all. Wow, it's all right. But you know, so it's just an interesting it's an interesting thing, right? Because we can always look back, and the thing is, when you look back on the undiagnosed years, it can be really easy to really pick them apart to the mm-hmm. nth degree, mm-hmm. because you feel like, oh, if I'd known that, then this might be different, or this might be different. But here's the truth. Like, we did think about it. We were playing in the dark for a very long time. And the fact that we came out of it the other side
mm-hmm.
is an absolute miracle.
Mm,
and
yeah.
like, kudos to us for actually navigating somehow, whether it be staying in or going out and abusing your body, you mm-hmm. got through it in whatever way yeah. you did. You got through it to the other side alive mm-hmm. and made it to a diagnosis, which obviously we'll come on to talk about now. But I just think it's amazing that we can go undiagnosed for so long, basically blindfolded, with all of these symptoms causing havoc in our lives and other people's, and still make it out in one piece somehow. Yeah. And I just think, yeah, that's quite an achievement.
Yeah, I was actually saying on the live stream I did for Bipolar UK on Friday, I said that we are very resilient, and by that I mean physically, our pain threshold is enormous, and I think we take that for granted. And I mean I just kind of had to start life over again. I think I really, looking back on it, and so often people who get a diagnosis think that it's a death sentence, and I think it's the complete opposite. It was my lifeline. It was finally we aren't in the dark anymore. And yeah, it's bittersweet that when you get that diagnosis, it feels like a weight has been lifted, but at the same time you're like, oh, okay, this is the new weight. Yeah.
And it's if I feel like we're sort of talking like we're mirroring each other, yeah, in the opposite fashion, because when I got my diagnosis, I felt like I was being told I had to put the brakes on, and I couldn't be reckless anymore. Mm-hmm. And that I was being told to slow down and stop, and, you know, all of these things. So although I welcomed the diagnosis because it would help me, I still felt sort of shackled in a way initially, because mm-hmm. I had been so reckless before. And yeah, so it's interesting how it lands so differently for people.
Yeah, well, there's one thing bipolar is, it's unpredictable for sure. Yeah,
this is true.
And I always found the most fascinating statistic, and I'm also one to say that I hate statistics, and I think, you know, we aren't a statistic, but this really hit home, to understand that it is within us, and I don't think we should shy away from that, is that it's 70% genetic and then 30% triggered by trauma.
Yeah.
So when what you were saying about looking back and picking it all apart is it's going, oh my God, that thing that I thought was horrific actually was horrific. And now I can see that 30% like igniting the rest of that 70%. Mm-hmm. And how that trauma also brought on the borderline personality disorder.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're like, and that's really that's why I went off the rails, because I just thought, oh man, I've been so hard done by here, and now I know what this is. I'm going to go and live my life a million miles per hour to make up for all the lost time.
Yeah.
When actually I should have been, it was then more than ever, I should have been looking after myself.
It just, the thing is, when we receive big news, processing it, there's no rules, right? And there's no rules. And it's interesting that you say about the trauma triggering, because I'm on board, like completely on board with that. And leading up to my breakdown, I sort of got higher and higher over a few years. Mm. And it was like a big events, relationship breakdown, 3 deaths close to me, and I kept going higher and higher and higher and higher until I just bang, didn't get out of bed. But by the time I was high, you know, I had a business, I had an, you know, office staff, and in there was whiteboards all over the walls, and the amount of business plans that I had written up that were started in action. I mean, it would have taken an army of like 100 people to complete them. I don't know what I thought I was doing.
I looked
back at some photos the other day and the whiteboard was in the background and I was like, holy moly, that was off the charts ambitious. Off the charts ambitious. But in that moment, if someone had come to me and said, don't you think that that's all a bit much? Absolutely not. I believe with the toes in my bones, it was possible, right?
I'm completely with you. That the ambition thing. We feel we're invincible, and it is. I always say it's that spark of genius and that creativity and gumption and seeing things in a sphere that no one else can do is really special. So we are going to have these million ideas, and you know, they're not many won't work, but I think what's great about what we have and why starting the company and things like that were kind of a no-brainer for me is because we don't have anything to lose as people mm-hmm. with living with bipolar, or I don't feel like I've ever got anything to lose because mm-hmm. I always say I've got a bit of a death wish, and I'll just go full steam ahead, whereas Sarah will step back and look at something and to a degree talk herself out of doing something mm-hmm. because she's sensible and stable and very intelligent, whereas I'm like, or why don't we just do it and just see how it explode in front of us. It is interesting, and I do believe I wouldn't have achieved, and I'm sure you'd agree with this, that wouldn't have achieved half the things that we have without it. And that's what my dad said. I always say this if people are watching this, is the first thing my dad said before anything else was, I always knew there was a spark of genius in you. And when Sarah found out, she went, oh, yeah, that makes so much sense now. And I like that. I kind of enjoy that penny drop in. And even my friendship circle, I didn't tell people. I spent nearly a year just keeping it within my close circle. And then when I publicly came out about it, it just felt this sigh of relief in my whole friendship group going, oh, that's what that is. Okay. All right then.
You're right, though. I love what your dad said. And, you know, the things that we can achieve when we've got the bipolar superhero cape on, you know, mm-hmm. they're huge things, and they're incredible things, some of the things that you can achieve. But that penny dropping moment when my best friend told that, she was like, yeah, that makes perfect sense, because you're either bouncing off the walls 100 mm-hmm. miles an hour, not needing any sleep, you know, running around, like juggling, the plate spinning, you know, all of that, or nothing. So it makes total sense. She was like, of course you are. Of course.
Do you find as well, on that note, do you find that because I'm having this today, so I've actually become quite high during the second lockdown, and I've definitely leveled out, or I can feel myself coming down from it. So when I was on that high, oh my God, I've got my fingers on all of the pulses. I know exactly what's happening. I know exactly what needs to happen. Whereas today, I've only been able to focus on one thing that doesn't even need focusing on. I just can't see past it. Honestly, before I came on with this, I was just like, April, you can't do anything with that today. That's something you got to do tomorrow. I was like, nope, can't see past it.
Yeah, it's just so interesting how the mind works, and sometimes you can be so on it, and I often feel when I'm like this, firing on all the cylinders, I get very frustrated with people around me because I feel like they're too slow. You know, quite often I'm like, you're too slow. Oh, because you don't get it, it's stupid, you know, and I have to watch that, and I've had to really try and relearn that over the years, because actually it's not them, it's me. But I'm like, you're too slow, just get out the way, I'll do it, my bang 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 bang, because I'm just thinking, God, and in my head I genuinely believe, why are you so slow, like, and in pace, I mean, like, mm-hmm. why are you going so slow?
Yeah,
because I've said it and I'm already on, and you can't even understand the thing I've just said, and I genuinely think you're really moving very, very slow here.
Yeah.
So it's, and then, but then it tips over for me and it becomes scattered thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can't think in a straight line. And then, you know, and then I'm going back over notepads and I can't even remember writing it. I'm thinking, oh my goodness, right, okay, right, highlighter, must do that, you know, must do that. Because I've agreed to do it. Oh God.
yeah. And like rewriting lists because you look at something on your list and you've written it in one way and I go, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. Let's rewrite the list and write that one thing in a different way to remind me in a different way. So much energy.
I know it is, isn't it? It takes a lot of work, doesn't it, just to you know, manage our own head.
That's without the repercussions of medication as well. That's why I'm saying to you off screen that before midday it is hell. Like, until that medication wears off, you will be dealing with a teenager. I will grunt at you until I can form words, unless I'm higher, and then I would have been up most of the night, so I wouldn't have even realized.
I used to feel like I'm not on medication right now, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't feature in my life. It's definitely there. I go through periods where I don't need it, but for the majority of the last 10 years, medication has absolutely been present. And at the beginning, quetiapin, and I used to feel like in the morning, one, so hungry, I needed to eat at least three breakfasts before I felt like it was normal breakfast time. And two, like a hangover, almost like a complete medication hangover that needs to, like, the fog needs to clear, I can't see. And this, guess what? I've had four breakfasts. The fog's just gone and now it's time for my three lunches. And that was just kind of my life for a while, you know? Well, 3 years I spent like that. So,
yeah, quetiapin. I do love it, though. I do support it, only because I didn't realise how little I slept until it was given to me. And I was actually forewarned about the food thing, and they said, you know, this notoriously makes you put weight on. But again, this is where I just hit this rock bottom where I was in the psychiatrist's place. I was getting told I had to go, and I just thought, go on, just give me, I'll deal with the weight gain, when in fact it's suppressed my hunger. I've lost probably nearly 2 stone on it, and it is it's been interesting because now I've had to like set alarms to remind myself to eat. The brain waves to tell you you're hungry just aren't there. If you put it in front of me, I'll be like, oh cool, I'll eat this, but otherwise nothing's telling my stomach that I'm hungry. But I totally get what you say. If when I was in this lockdown, when I was having a wonderful time flying around, one night I kind of self-medicate in terms of not alcohol, wasn't drinking this lockdown, but I am usually on 100 milligrams. And sometimes if I know I have to get up early, I might take that at 8:30 to make sure I'm asleep by 10:30. But one night I took 300 milligram at 10 p.m. and was still buzzing at 3:30 in the morning. And you're like, oh, because these knock you out.
Yeah, I
totally get the hungover thing today. I got that. Yeah. Totally foggy.
I'm just utterly grateful that quetiapin showed up in my life, because the truth is it saved my life. Without it, my behavior was so reckless, so impulsive, so unpredictable, that through that recklessness and impulsiveness, I probably would have ended my own life in those moments where I was sort of mixed between suicidal and hypermanic. And in that moment, you then get those pockets of, like, you know, impulsivity and recklessness. I did. So for me, quetiapin literally just bought me, you know, the mood scale +5 to a -5.
Actually, I'd
like to take a minute to talk about that. So, like, that mood scale +5 to -5, when I first went and they got me to do my mood to assess me, because I'd gone on antidepressants, gone sky high. I remember looking at that and seeing the zero and thinking in my head, because at the time I was paranoid because I'd gone high and I thought spies were coming to get me. But I looked at the zero and I thought, that's another trick. I thought that doesn't exist. This feeling of not high, not low, outlook on life is good. I genuinely had never felt like that in my entire life at the age of 29. And I remember looking at it thinking, this is obviously part of the assessment. And this is a trick question, because that feeling, that experience doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. So it's in there, but it's like a red herring answer is what I thought. Yeah. Right. So I went away with my little graph, did my plots, came back and then other assessments. Yes, we think you've got bipolar. So diagnosed me with bipolar, gave me the quetiapine, sent me away with a new little graph to fill in. And within days, I plotted a zero. I could not believe it. I felt like, even though I felt nothing, I felt like I'd hit the jackpot. I went back in, I literally skipped in, and I was like, you are never going to believe what's happened. And they're like, what's happened, Emma? And I was like, Emma, plotted a zero. I was like, can you believe it? And they said, well, yes, lots of people feel like that. I said, and that's when I confessed. I said, I did not believe that was a true answer. I thought it was in there as some sort of trick, because I'm 29 years old and I genuinely have never felt that way. And it was like I can't even explain how it felt. It's like an epiphany. Wow, what people feel like this. This is mad. I remember saying that to my psychiatrist. The fact that people feel like this, no symptoms of mania, no symptoms of depression, outlook on life is good. The fact that people feel like that to me is mad. That to me is crazy, right? Because I've never had that.
I totally agree. And I love that. I love that realization. Like when you plotted that zero, what did the spies think that you thought were coming after you? Were they?
Well, they'd gone, right?
Oh, they'd gone because they'd gone. Hit the zero.
Because I'd hit the zero. And it was like this clear thinking. And my thinking just went from being like this, like all scattered, to in a straight line, like orderly. My thoughts were orderly. I didn't feel down. I didn't feel up. I didn't really feel anything, to be fair. Bit sort of flat, lined, but not down. And I just couldn't believe that I'd put a little cross on the zero, because it blew my mind that normal people out there felt that way. I just couldn't get my head around it.
I go between not trusting and being incredibly jealous of the friends who just have stable mental health, and I didn't know it existed. Like I just thought, surely everyone, and obviously everyone has mental health and they go through periods, but I have friends who are just like this all of the time. And I go, I wonder what it's like to be in their head. Like, is it, I just can't imagine it. What is that feeling? And I'd love for people to just be in our head, even if it's just for an hour. Yeah. And just feel the chaos and the whirlwind. I just wonder if it's not so much a tumbleweed, but kind of that feeling in some of my friends' heads, where it's just like, I hear voices all of the time, and it is that is something I've only come to realize in the last 4 years that is what that is, because I realized no one else had it, and I was like, oh. don't do it. I have a bit of a love-hate relationship with those number moody things. I didn't quite grasp it when I was 18, and I kind of I know we spoke a bit about anger, but when I couldn't grasp something, and when I just was like, how am I supposed to put a number to my mood? Like, how will they know? How do I know? And it's interesting. It's always interesting, isn't it?
And the thing is, until we start exploring how other people's moods present in people that don't have mental health illnesses mm-hmm. and people that do. Until we have that realization that we have a mental health condition, why would we think that how we feel is anything other than normal anyway, right? So to me, it was normal. Everyone else wasn't normal. Mm. I couldn't understand why other people couldn't keep up. I couldn't understand when I was busy why other people needed more than an hour's sleep. I was like, what's wrong with you? Get up, let's go. We've got stuff to do, projects to do, things to do. Let's go, places to be. And people were like, Emma, I'm knackered. I need to go to sleep. I'm so tired. Aren't you tired? I'd be like, no, I'm not tired. I could stay awake for 3 days. What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
You know? But until you know different, you don't know any different, right?
Yeah. It's I totally agree. I just always go back to when I was at drama school, and that's 3 years, and I hadn't been diagnosed. I had a traumatic event happen, but we realized because it was 10 years ago, you know, mental illness wasn't, I mean, I didn't know what bipolar was a thing until I was 24, 25. But going to drama school, I couldn't get a house share because somehow between me and my parents, we knew I couldn't live alone. Couldn't tell you why, but collectively we were like, no, you need to live by yourself, which is what I did. And then thinking about not wanting to go out and the fear of going out and drinking with people and not trusting what's being said, and then doing acting class. And purposely, I remember this vividly, we had to do a method acting class when you really draw upon personal experience and all this. I kid you not, everyone was in tears and I was just like, nothing, absolutely feel nothing. And then so what you're saying is, I completely agree, everything felt normal, and things that I feel now, I think, oh, but other people should be able to function like this, like should be able to function like this, they should be able to not need sleep, they should be able to think about this and this. But at that time I knew I was very different, and because I was in the minority, I felt like a freak. I just did. Why at the age of 19 do you not want to go and be doing shots off of people's bodies? I don't know. Is that what I just do now? I'm not sure. But why don't you want to be doing that?
Yeah,
actually thinking back on it, I never really talk about it and a drama school experience, because I came out of secondary school and then came out of drama school and just started over both times, just wiped the slate clean. Everyone looks at your uni years, everyone looks at, especially when you're at drama school, it's fame, the musical, not actual fame. And I look back on it and it's desperately sad. I think about the stuff I was doing and that breaks my heart. And don't you find that when you think to your little self, and I'm still in this position when I look at her and I feel very sorry for her, and I wish I had more information at the time, and I wish I could have a do-over and do good by her.
Yeah, I mean, often I look back at my younger self and I think, gosh, you had no idea what this effect was having on you, and all of the roads it took me down as a result that led to further pain, further trauma, further chaos. I do feel sad for that younger version of myself. But that's also something that I'm really passionate about doing now, is inner child work now, because we can go back and reparent those parts of ourselves if we learn those tools and skills and those mindfulness techniques. All is not lost, I suppose, in terms of being able to go back and offer compassion and empathy to that period of our lives, which in itself pays forward and helps us to settle as our older selves. But there's definitely a grieving process that has to take place.
Yeah, and that's right where I am at the moment. And it's hard to let go when you hold that shame and you hold that guilt. I think it's just incredibly lonely. I feel lonely in my adult self, and I feel lonely for the inner child. And it's now just trying to work out how you can work together with that, and you can also keep that inner child alive and unite.
And
loneliness is a killer. That's
grieving for that past self that didn't have the tools that they needed, or the awareness that they needed, or the support that they needed, is absolutely okay.
Yeah.
And to grieve for it, whether it's 10 years, 20 years, 30 years later, is so validating for that younger version of ourselves that it can be incredibly healing. It's something I'm so passionate about. But it can be incredibly healing to the person that we are today, and can teach us to forgive ourselves for all the things we didn't know. Mm-hmm. But guess what? We don't know what we don't know.
Exactly. So it's so funny you to bring that up, because that is the sole focus of the last couple of months within therapy. And it's one of those things in a film when someone pretty much goes to you, it's okay, you know you didn't do anything wrong, and actually hearing that and processing it is it's a foot off the chest, isn't it? And you're like, oh god,
in a therapeutic setting, the therapist said to me, you know, what was it that 16-year-old Emma needed to hear? And she got me to say it out loud to myself, and I just fell apart and sobbed. And what was actually happening is I was grieving and allowing myself to feel everything that I needed to feel back then, but also letting go of the sorrow that I feel now for that version of Emma. And it's incredibly powerful, incredibly healing. We do a whole podcast just on this topic, I'm sure, but because it's so good and so powerful. And it has to come at the right time for everybody as well. Like, everyone comes to these different experiences at different times when it's the right time. But yeah, definitely a very powerful part of my therapy, for sure.
I agree.
Yeah. I'm glad you're doing it, and it helps for me. It's helped me to have more forgiveness and compassion and grace for myself, not be so hard on myself, and just sort of settle into that and just think, actually, it's okay. Shed shame. You know,
well, exactly. Yeah, you're definitely a little bit ahead of me. I'm still very I am just still looking at her, quite fascinated. And actually she just couldn't do anything. It was so unusual and unlike pretty much anything it was just very peculiar. And now you're going, sorry, I feel like my dad's about to make an appearance. You're going to be quiet, Dad. He's notorious for barging in on these things and just making a lot of noise. Really,
hi, Dad. Hi, April's Dad.
Yeah. Emma says hi.
Welcome, Dad.
The dog's up and running now. You're definitely ahead, and I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. And how each session going on, it just breaks it down a little bit more. Unusually as well, though, I do not cry in therapy. I'll cry after therapy, but for some reason I'm just like, it's now become a challenge not to cry. I mean riddle me that, Emma.
Oh, everyone's different, right? And there's no right or wrong way to do any of this. Like, do whatever feels right for you. And mimicking someone else's journey never works, right? Because then we're back into pretending. Exactly. So we have to just do our journey as we do it, but love ourselves with every step that we take. So that's the biggest thing. No matter how hard or high the steps, just with each step, just say, I love you as you do this, right?
Even if
you don't get it right, and even if it's not perfect, and even if it's messy, and even if there's not crying or no crying, like just it's okay, and you're doing a good job, I think is the most important message to tell ourselves while we navigate this big stuff.
Totally. And trying, just by even acknowledging and trying to do something is huge. You know, don't aim on I think so often I aim for the end goal, and then if I don't achieve that immediately, I think I've failed. Whereas actually going back into therapy, because you go into it and I'm just like, fix me. And then it just, I don't know why that was my attitude. I really hated it. And now as each week goes, you go, well, you're here again, April, and you're trying again. You're really trying. I always say as well, each day as it comes, and when that's too hard, hour by hour.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's layers as well. I found with therapy over the years, different types of therapy. And it's all right to take a break too. Here's the other thing. Like, we might do therapy for a bit, and then maybe we need to take a break from that, because we need time to process all of the stuff that we've just done. You know, so for me, getting diagnosed at 29, I don't get to 29 and then do 1 year's worth of therapy and everything's fixed, right? 29 years worth of stuff unpacking to do. So we can go to therapy, we can unpack a bit. And then guess what? Maybe we need to just kind of sit and look at our unpacking and sit in that for a little while. And then we go back. And the thing is, when you go back, like go back and when you're called to do so, but when you go back, you'll generally find that you're kind of looking at it through a slightly different lens, and you're peeling back another layer, and it's a slightly different layer to the layer you went to before. And then you can get to a point where you think, for me, I got to a point, I was like, well, I'm kind of done with this bit now. And I just want to go and be for a bit. And then I'd be like, oh, and then something would start kicking off again in me emotionally. I'd be like, right, actually, I need to go back and do a bit more unpacking. And it's okay. Slow and steady. It's okay.
Yeah, I agree.
It's not a race. Therapy is not a race.
Nope. I've tried it and I can assure you it's not a race.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I was like that straight out the thing, like galloping, you know, and then you get fatigue, right? Therapy fatigue. Yeah. Like, I think it's a thing. I'm sure it is.
And then I'm so good at hiding stuff, like really good. So for the first probably couple of months, I just thought it was a one woman show, and to the point of something happened to trigger a bad episode, and I went there and I couldn't hide. And when that usually happens, I just don't show up, but I'd already paid for this, so I thought I better show up. And she said, today's the first time I've actually seen you, and not a performer. And I was like, fine, let's give this a go then.
Yeah. And I suppose also the fact that you went to drama school, it adds a layer of putting on, like, even anyone that doesn't go to drama school learns, when you have a mental health condition, we learn very quickly how to put on a face. So for you going to drama school, like, there's that added layer of, like, I don't know, expert. You're an expert at that, right?
I wouldn't say that about much I can do, but yeah, that for sure.
Yeah,
like, because you know what people want to hear, and with bipolar as well, I feel like we're hyper aware and in tune of even if it's not our own emotions, I think we can sense it. And I think people are drawn to us, whether I always say that, I don't want to say the wrong thing, but people that have lived through stuff, people that are open and live through stuff, draw other people, because they don't want to speak to someone whose life is seemingly perfect. They want to speak to a human. And then I feel like our personalities are quite intoxicating. So then you learn how to get by. You learn, especially in this industry, you're constantly meeting new people. You're going and getting chucked into rooms of people. You mold. You go, right, what room, what does this room want to see? What do you want me to be? And that's been such an ongoing battle. But yeah, it's, I think that's been the ongoing battle of finally sitting in it. And I said during this first lockdown, for the first time ever, even though being an ambassador, I went, oh God, yeah, I'm ill. I'm actually, no, that's it. Because there was no busy, London life. I was not getting chucked into any rooms, and I was just there. And I think that was probably the biggest thing I learned in lockdown. I mean, it was not a surprise to anyone else. They were like, yeah, we know you're on medication, you go to therapy. I was like, why didn't you tell me?
It's a tough journey, hey? And how does, I want to just talk a little bit, I know we touched on it before we went live recording, I touched a little bit on rapid cycling, because I know you mentioned that does feature for you in your bipolar, living with bipolar. Could you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's, again, it's something that really became apparent in lockdown. Sarah initially said, you're very undulating. And I felt like that sounded something you would pour on cheesecake, but I was here for it. and I actually, when I was in drama school, for some reason, again, not really knowing that it was mental illness. It was, obviously I was on antidepressants, but I hadn't been formally diagnosed. And I could mark my cycles every 6 weeks. I can't remember now, 5 weeks good, and then 1 week off, and then that cycle would go again. And it would just be one intense low week. And then I came out of drama school, and the career began and the company started going, and I lost track of it all. And the thing is, because I kept myself to myself at drama school, I could manage it. But then you come out and you're in the real world, and you can't be a hermit inside. You've got to get on with it. And I lost track of it all. And then I realized with the borderline, it's very... yeah, I think borderline is very driven by relationships, whether that's friendship or romantic. And I was quite exposed to a lot of different things. I couldn't hold down a relationship. So I was getting triggered by tiny things, minuscule things, someone not replying on time, ridiculous things. And it would send me off in a spiral. And then that low, I would force to chase a high. I just had myself in a really vicious cycle for a long time. And then I came into lockdown and I didn't have any of those vices. Actually, I drank way too much in first lockdown, like really, really badly on hindsight. But then I could work it out. And for me, I can be high for a week or so. But apart from that, it is a daily thing. So I woke up, I woke up this morning and was just like, nah, I'm not doing today. I thought at one point I'm gonna have to email Emma and say I can't do this. And then by 1 PM I was like, oh, let's do everything. Come on, we're gonna do it. Let's wrap some Christmas presents. And I hate to say it, it really is unpredictable, and I can do as much as I can do. And the best thing I have done and helped myself in this second lockdown is to acknowledge it. I've gone, oh, okay, well, that's a weird feeling. I don't think I should be feeling that right now. What do we think is causing this? Okay, let's write down these three things. Okay, Well, no, you've just made these two up in your head, and this isn't an issue until next week. Okay, cool. And really just taking that time to own it and not go in, just going to ignore that. And I'm going to message the person, see if he wants to go for a beer, or I'm going to throw a grenade into this situation. And I'm going to bury my head into work. So, yes, I'm very much a rapid cycler. And I'm trying. I'm just really trying now. That's what I just kind of owe it to my parents and loved ones to really try at the moment, because yeah, put them through a bit of hell. So yeah, that's all we can
It's
do.
hard, isn't it? It's hard because it not only does it impact us, but the impact it has on the people around us, and then we end up trying to carry like our burden, their burden, everyone's burden, and I know firsthand it's just a difficult, impossible space to be in a lot of the time. So, and before we go, could you share with any listeners the most helpful thing or things that people could say or do to support you personally that you found in your experience?
Or just all of a sudden I've got a load of things not to say. I think by, funny enough, not saying too much helps. It makes me feel I can see that I'm seen. I can see that I've been acknowledged, but sometimes the more they say, the more I feel like I've become a burden, and let me learn to articulate this a bit better. So we have this dialogue with the people around me where I'm pretty sure they all chat. I know my parents chat to certain friends and things like that. And they don't crisis manage me in a traditional sense. So actually, some of the best things that I can hear is, what are you doing for dinner tonight? Have you eaten today? Have you got out the house? Do you fancy going for a walk? I've got the dog in now. Like those things, because I know in deep down or on reflection, they are basically saying, are you okay? We know you're not okay. What do you want us to do? Don't say that. Actually suggest something. And that makes me feel less alien. It makes me feel like I'm not doing something too wrong, and that actually you want to spend time with me.
And my two are quite similar to yours. Like, and sometimes I can't even cope with the question of what do you want to eat? Just present me with a plate of food, you know. Because I say that to my partner, I'm like, just if in doubt, just bring the plate of food. Just bring it. Because I can't even think about what I want or what I don't want. So I will turn around and say, no, I'm all right, thanks. I don't need anything. And I haven't eaten all day, you know. So just but if you present it in front of me and then say, you know, and then afterwards, maybe in an hour, do you want to go for a walk? I'm with you. Super, super helpful things to not make you feel alone and to make sure you've got food in your belly, right? The basics. A huge,
I know.
huge.
It is you are effectively a child, but also that inner child, that's all we wanted back then as well. When people found out I was doing second lockdown on my own, oh my God, the amount of walks I got offered, I felt like a puppy. It was great. And it was so strange, because obviously people, you know, were saying if you need anything, but I also know that people don't often say that around me now, because they actually offer something. Because by saying, do you need anything, I'm like, where do you begin? You know, a stable mind, like a relationship or anything. So do you need anything? Yes, everything immediately.
Yeah. New make brain, it happen. Please.
So actually saying like specifically, you know, going for a walk, or I've got a support bubble. So it's like, right, I'm going to come around and we're going to watch that film tonight. And it's yeah. so, it honestly, it's so tiny.
Yeah, but massive.
Exactly. Massive. Simple.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you, April. Thank you so much for sharing so honestly and candidly with me today. Where can we find you?
Where can you find me? You can find me on Twitter at April_Kelly. I had to put a double underscore in there. And on Instagram at April_Kelly, KELLEY.
Amazing. You're amazing. Thank You're you amazing. So much. Thank you. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Let's Talk Bipolar, the podcast brought to you by Bipolar UK. Please go to our website, www.bipolaruk.org, for all of our resources and all of the support that we can offer you.